Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us for today's webinar called Food Matters for Autism, Learn Why and How. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. I have a 13-year-old son with autism, and I've been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at the age of 4. I've served as president of the Autism Society Dayton chapter. I've worked as the assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, and I'm a regular contributor to Autism Today. There's two ways to listen to today's webinar. You can log in to momsfightingautism.com. The webinar is completely free. Once you're registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, and there you can click Listen In and hear the discussion via the Internet. You can click Ask a Question if you'd like to submit a question for our speaker. And you can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806. And enter conference ID number 168978#. All callers are immediately muted, so don't worry about background noises. We can't hear you. Later in our webinar, I'll let telephone listeners know how they can ask a question directly to our presenter if they wish. We will try to get to as many of the questions and the common themes as we can in the time that we have allotted today. When the slideshow begins, Internet users can go to their blue box and click Slides to view the slideshow. It'll take about 16 seconds to connect, so don't worry, it will connect. And once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio, whichever way you're listening, by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Mute your computer if you're listening via phone so you don't get an echo. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce Julie Matthews, who will be presenting today, Food Matters for Autism, Learn Why and How. Julie is an internationally respected certified nutrition consultant specializing in autism spectrum disorder and the author of the award-winning book, Nourishing Hope for Autism. She educates parents and physicians of the options, science, and how-to of healing diets for children with autism. Julie educates at the leading autism conferences in the U.S. and abroad. Her work is based in scientific research, clinical experience, and an understanding of the biochemistry of autism and the role of nutrition to aid healing and relieve symptoms. Julie has a private nutrition practice and a radio show in San Francisco, California, and supports families and clinicians from around the world. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm so glad to be here, Nancy. All right. Well, let's get started. I'm excited to be here and share all of this with those of you that are out here. I wanted to start with what we're going to cover today. So we have about 90 minutes, and I'm going to go through an understanding of what I call setting the stage, so understanding autism as a whole body disorder and how diet and nutrition play a role in that. Then I'm going to go into nutrition and what to remove from the diet and what to add and replenish in the diet. We'll talk about autism diets, particularly the GFCF diet and a few others, and we'll talk about picky eaters because I think picky eating is so common among children that I think it's really important to address. So if you have a picky eater, realize that even though some of the things I'm going to talk about seem maybe a little far from where you are right now, I am going to get to picky eating and how to pull it all together, and then some steps for getting started. So we'll do that, and then we'll set some time at the end for some Q&A so you can get your questions answered as well. And I see some people have already even asked some questions, so that's great. All right, here. So all of you, I'm sure, are aware of the symptoms in the diagnostic interpretation for autism, so I won't go through that, but I wanted to highlight the physical symptoms because a lot of people aren't aware and don't make the connection that there are also a lot of physical symptoms that people with autism share, and it's often digestive disturbances, hyperactivity, sleeping challenges, aches and pains and all sorts of different things, skin rashes. And so when you understand that autism not only has certain behavioral and communication type of symptoms, but also has certain physical symptoms, we can start to see a model emerge from here, an understanding that there's more going on than just in the brain. And when we see that what's happening in the body affects what's happening in the brain, then we understand how we can go forward and address that through the use of food and nutrition. So autism is really a combination of genetic predisposition and environmental assault. So not everybody with certain genetics gets autism, and just getting a particular environmental assault or multiple ones doesn't necessarily mean all of those people get autism. So it's really a combination of those two factors coming together. So the genetic predisposition can be the fixed gene sequence that we are born with, but it also, and I think more likely, is our gene expression, and that's the ability for the body to turn on and turn off certain genes so that we're able to rapidly adapt to our environment. And this is the study called epigenetics. And interestingly, this area of turning these genes on and off is really influenced very significantly by exposure to toxins and poor nutritional status. So, you know, when you see that a lot of children with autism have poor detoxification and often exposure to toxins at various times, as well as often the need for nutrients, a lot of nutrient deficiencies, you can see that, wow, this is, I think, one of the reasons why we're seeing more and more of this today. We have a lot of toxins in our environment. We have a lot of poor nutrition going on. And so when we take that genetic situation and we combine that with certain environmental assaults, also really heavy in our environment today, heavy metals, exposure to viruses and various things, plastics, pesticides, environmental toxins, all of these things can be the trigger that someone that has maybe a genetic weakness in a particular area or less ability to detoxify things or a host of different challenges, then this is usually where that combination comes together. And again, by understanding this, there's certain things that we can do to avoid toxins in our environment as well. So when we see autism as a whole body disorder, the part on the left-hand side here is an explanation. This is actually a little chart from my book, and it's just kind of showing the intercomplexity of all the things that can go on in the body. And then you look and see, these things can also directly affect the brain. So Dr. Martha Herbert coined the term whole body disorder and the brain being downstream from all that biochemistry. So the brain is not an isolated island to its own where there's sort of this autism is this mysterious condition, but by understanding, all these things that are happening in the body, yeast overgrowth creating toxins, inflammation causing brain inflammation, exposure to toxicity and decreased detoxification affecting the brain, when we don't have enough when we have inflammation and a gut that's not kind of working properly, we can get nutrient deficiencies by not being able to digest and absorb our nutrients well. And of course, some of those nutrients are really needed for the brain to function. And also, if we can't, our digestion's not working well, we don't always break down the foods we need properly. And with certain foods like wheat and dairy, they can actually create opiate-type compounds. And we all know that opiates, morphine, and those sorts of things really have a significant impact on the brain. So when we see that what's happening in the body affects what's happening in the brain, we're going to talk today all about how the foods that we eat can affect the body as a whole and therefore affect the symptoms of autism specifically. So this is just a little biochemistry slide. I'm not really going to go into the biochemistry. Just wanted to kind of show you, if you are curious, if you're interested in more of this, I think I have like 40 pages or something in my book that explains this chart that I created here. But just probably for our discussion today, a couple things to note. The blue part of the pathway at the top is influenced by some nutrients that are often fairly deficient in children with autism or adults as well, of course. If I say children children with autism, it's only because I tend to have, a lot more discussion around new diagnoses and new people coming in. So children is more in my mindset. But, of course, I'm applying this to everyone, including adults. So folic acid and B12 are two of those nutrients that are often deficient, and they're needed for the recycling in that pathway. And that blue box, that blue set of functions handles that epigenetics, that DNA methylation piece of it, so that's kind of interesting, as well as all sorts of factors in terms of neurotransmitters, myelination of nerves, all sorts of things that we need to function well. And that first part is required for the second part, which is glutathione, and glutathione is really important for virus fighting and in detoxification and a whole host of other things. So, and that part of the process requires B6 and magnesium and, again, a whole bunch of nutrients. So you can see that a lot of nutrients are really needed for these pathways that are interdependent to work. And the one thing I want to say about that little orange box is sulfation is necessary for a set of foods that we're going to talk about, which are called phenols and salicylates. So if you remember later in our conversation, we're talking about phenols or salicylates. That's this little orange part of the process here. So you can imagine we need the blue, the green to function in order to even get to the orange part, and that needs to function in order to process certain foods that are normally really healthy for us. But if we don't have these pathways working, we can have a challenge. And in autism, we often see that very thing. So the red arrows are showing where those deficiencies in the methylation part of the cycle, the glutathione piece, and the sulfation piece. Okay. So how does all this relate together? So what I see is when I think of autism, I think of three kind of main buckets, if you will. I think of the immune system, digestion, and detoxification. Often these three systems have some deficiency in children and adults with autism where everyone is different, and certain people are going to have maybe one bucket that's bigger and more imbalanced than someone else. But more or less, this is kind of a lot of what we see. So when we have the immune system, the inability to fight viruses and bacteria and things well, and also an increased inflammatory response that doesn't shut off as appropriate. The digestive system creating inflammation and imbalance of bacteria, the good and the bad being imbalanced, dysbiosis, and then detoxification and that not working ideally. And when that happens, you see all of the effects on the neurological system and the effects that we see with a lot of children and adults in terms of the brain the symptoms that we often associate with autism. So this, in a way, just a different way of representing that other chart that I just showed you. And the gut is in a really important part of this process. So the thing about food is the food is constantly in contact with this digestive system every time we eat, and we eat every single day, many times a day. So the food that we eat can be really healthy and nourishing and helpful to the gut and the whole body, or it can be inflammatory, even almost toxic in some ways to the body. So we want to really choose food well. The gut handles a big part of the immune system, a big part of the neurotransmitters in our body, and the absorption and digestion and utilization, or the absorption and digestion of nutrients for that proper utilization of them. So the gut handles a lot, and Hippocrates said that all disease begins in the gut, and the more you study the body, and the more I do, the more you begin to realize, wow, most disease really does begin in the gut. The gut is a primary place to heal and to work on to help support all the systems of the body. So again, we're going to come back. A lot of the principles relate to how to make food more digestible, more, choosing foods that are supportive for the system. So there's a lot of nutrient deficiencies in autism. Some of the minerals, calcium, magnesium, zinc are some of the common ones. B vitamins are really vital and important and often deficient. And these deficiencies are both come from studies that were done as well as a lot of clinical experience from various doctors and other clinicians that have studied and tested the individuals for different deficiencies, and this is where a lot of this information comes from. Vitamin A and vitamin D are really, really important ones, these fat-soluble vitamins that our bodies need to convert. And so if we're not doing so well, we don't always make these conversions so well. And so there are some food ways to get these nutrients as well. Vitamin C, an important antioxidant, as well as the omega-3 fatty acids, and a whole host of amino acids. And these amino acids are the building blocks for various detoxification functions and other processes. So where do all these deficiencies come from? Why do children and people with autism have so many deficiencies? Well, when you see all of these ways, it actually isn't really surprising that they do. So firstly is a deficiency in our ability to digest and absorb. So that can be, we need to eat good food, but we need to be able to digest it and break it down as well as absorb it through the system in order to have those nutrients available. Deficiencies also stem from the inability for the cells to be able to utilize the nutrients properly. So the cells need to be able to use them. We also need to convert them to the active form. So let's take something like folic acid. It needs to go through a number of steps to go from folic acid or folate to 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, the active form. And that requires a whole host of things like proper enzymes and nutrients and all sorts of things that are needed to make those conversions. When we have increased toxins in our system or exposure to them and or inflammation or food additives, these are things that our body needs to use the nutrients that we have to absorb and help to remedy that situation. So we're using up the nutrients that we have to just solve some of these kind of fires that are going on. When there's a lack of good bacteria, those good bacteria are needed to create many vitamins and break down foods properly, so even medications and various other things, insufficient intake of food and nutrients and calories just in general. So, when you see all of these ways, wow, now it's not surprising that children are deficient in many of these important nutrients. So how can diet help? Well, we can support digestion and biochemistry in various ways. So when we have a leaky gut, that's a gut that is not absorbing those nutrients properly. Often has a lot of inflammation and other things going on. We want to remove the foods that inflame the gut. So we want to remove often, it might be wheat, it might be gluten, might be dairy, all sorts of different things, and we'll go through many of those during this presentation. We want to add foods that help to reduce inflammation and aid healing in the body, maybe antioxidants, good bacteria, things like that. When there's nutrient deficiencies, we want to look at increasing the quality of the food. So this is where, picky eaters come in, or any kids really in general. We want to get that good nutrient-dense foods. We want to find foods that they like. And that's a lot of actually what I do in my practice is help parents figure out how can we make these foods in a form that kids are going to actually enjoy eating these foods? And how do we make them more digestible so that we can actually absorb and have access to the nutrients that are in there? When we have yeast overgrowth, an imbalance of yeast, we want to remove sugars that feed that yeast. We also want to reduce often the refined flour products and the starches and things in the diet that can also feed yeast and add some good fermented probiotic-rich foods. When there's toxicity and poor detoxification, we want to avoid food additives that have to be processed by the liver, and we want to avoid toxins coming in from our food supply and meal preparation and things. We have chemistry. We can avoid those phenolic foods that we'll jump into in a little bit, as well as boosting up the pathways that were in that chart that I showed you through some supplementation when needed. So what do parents report when they do diet? Well, it's a wide range of things, from very dramatic improvements to step-by-step incremental improvements as they make changes over time. And so it's often related to digestive disturbances improving. That's one of the first things. And that makes a lot of sense, since that food that we're choosing to come in contact with the gut, we're going to choose better foods for that. But you don't have to have digestive problems in order to benefit from diet. You also see a lot of improvements in language, skills that children learn in therapy. You'll often hear the therapist share, "Wow, you know, I'm not sure what you changed, but it's going really well, so keep it up," kind of comments. Greater focus and attention, reduced hyperactivity, better sleeping, good eye contact. A host of challenges improving in various different areas, some of them directly related to the symptoms that we see in autism, and some of them related to some of that underlying health and the body systems. All right, so let's get into some nutrition here. Okay, so less than one-third of American children in general meet the needs for the RDA for fruits and vegetables. And that's your typical kids. So if you imagine that, then if you take picky eaters, that number is much smaller. And when you look at the restrictive diets that they're on, the fact that they often have nutrient deficiencies to begin with, the fact that they're often on restrictive diets, either self-determined limiting diets or sometimes special diets that maybe aren't done as nutrient densely as needed, you can see that nutrition is really an important area to address with autism. And when we just think about just common sense, we know that for diabetes and all sorts of conditions, it's really important to address diet. We know that celiac, you need to address removing gluten. So, you know, it's not really surprising to, when you think about, you know, food makes a difference. Food is an important part of our health, and so it's not any different for people with autism. Today, it's even more important because of the modern processing of food. The processing of food, we only had about 10% of our food processed in 1910. Now over 80% of it is. And you lose a lot of important nutrients during that processing. So, you know, we're having even less nutrients available to us. Also, the farming methods with the monocrop farming and the pesticides and the, non-organic repletion of nutrients, we have a lot of nutrient deficiencies that come from just the way that we raise the food. And then additives, adding that burden that our bodies need to find some nutrients or find ways to process them. So this is a chart from my book. I go through, in Nourishing Hope, I go through 12 different steps of step-by-step changes that you can do to start addressing diet. And we're going to talk about a number of these steps in some detail today. So cleaning up the diet and some supplement basics and some diet basics and getting started with a diet. Quite a few of them. We're going to get to some of the beginning steps here. Okay, so what is diet and what is a healthy diet? Well, firstly, it's removing. So I like to think of removing the offending foods, and this is pretty much what all the autism diets are based on. So if you want to do a GFCF diet, then you're going to be removing gluten, you're going to be removing dairy, specific carbohydrate diet, remove starches, the fail-safe diet and the Feingold diet, remove phenols, the low oxalate diet removes oxalate. So you can see the pattern here. Step one is pretty much all the diets are based on step one. But they all are missing the crucial piece of step two, which is to replenish, add healthy, nutritious foods and nutrient-dense foods to that diet. And that's for all the reasons we mentioned earlier. So we want to make sure that we're removing those things in that diet, but we also want to make sure we're getting those nutrients replenished through the diet as well. So what do we want to remove? So the first thing is food additives, removing ingredients that all of us have to detoxify through the liver, that we have to pay particular attention to. Those are artificial ingredients, artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives. These are loaded in kids' foods, and so this is something that we really need to look at. Something that's really easy to avoid, actually, if we're just aware and reading the labels. So that, before you do anything, just doing that can make a really big difference. They did a study in 2007 showing that children were really affected by the artificial ingredients creating hyperactivity in typical children. So you can imagine if your detoxification was less than the average person, you're going to be affected even in more significant ways by those. So get those out. That's the first thing. MSG, monosodium glutamate, but there's also these hidden sources of free glutamate, of, you know, basically another sort of version of MSG, and these are hydrolyzed vegetable protein, autolyzed yeast, different yeast extracts, and you're going to find those in meat-flavored and cheese-flavored things, so everything from broths and soups and gravies to meat-flavored like vegetarian types of meat substitutes and things like that. Pesticides, those are important to remove, artificial sweeteners, high fructose corn syrup, and then trans fats. So trans fats is another really important one. We want to read the labels and make sure, because it's a little deceiving. There's some rules about when you can say that it contains no trans fats, and actually there can be some trans fats in the ingredients if it's low enough per serving size. They can actually say that there are no trans fats. So you want to read the ingredients, and you want to look for things like partially hydrogenated oils, and you want to look at your commercial peanut butters, your commercial margarines and mayonnaise, and see if you find any of those partially hydrogenated oils in there. And then sodium nitrite, looking at the lunch meats and bacons and things, finding something that's free of that sodium nitrite. So pesticides. There were some studies in observation that went on at Penn State, and I won't go into all the details of that now, but showing everything from birth defects to endocrine disruption and nerve disorders and all sorts of things associated with pesticides. And there were some other studies. In 2010, there was a study on ADHD showing a 35% increase in developing ADHD with every tenfold increase in concentration of pesticides residues found in the urine. And in 2007, they did a study of women who lived a short distance from where some pesticides were sprayed during the first trimester of pregnancy, and there was a significant increase in the rates of autism. So that is something to make note of and do your best to avoid those pesticides. They really are not just bad in general, but really show how they can affect our systems in terms of autism. All right, so I know that in an ideal world, we'd probably all want to avoid pesticides and eat everything organic, but because of location, seasonality, budget, various things, we may not always be able to choose organic. So these are the Dirty Dozen. These were What they did was the Environmental Working Group tested all the conventional produce and found the heaviest pesticide-laden foods and put them into their list called the Dirty Dozen. And so number one being celery, number three strawberries, and it goes down the list of the top 10. To me, these are ones that I would only buy organic. So if it wasn't in season, if I couldn't get it, if I couldn't find it organic, I personally wouldn't eat these or feed them to my children. There's better choices. So with that, there's also the Clean 15. And while, again, personally, if I had a choice, I would choose everything organic. If you're in a pinch, or if you need to make a better choice, these are some of the better choices when you need to. These are the top cleanest foods that have the least pesticide residue when they're conventionally grown. All right. So something else important to remove is sugar. So sugar has several detrimental effects. Firstly, when we are looking at yeast overgrowth, so when you get too many antibiotics, it kills off the good bacteria as well as the bad, and that allows for yeast, which isn't killed off by that and is normally kept in check by that good bacteria, to overgrow out of control. And so for various reasons, that immune function and other things, it's fairly common for people with autism to have yeast overgrowth. And as such, sugar is something to avoid. So in terms of that, also sugar depresses the immune system and contributes to inflammation, things that we saw earlier that are challenges to many people. And so avoiding that sugar has many positive reasons. Sugarcane itself, it's not necessarily the evil sugar, but it is a common food sensitivity, and it uses a lot of chemicals in the processing of it. So, some people will avoid it altogether if their child is sensitive to it. Other people will choose to go with an unrefined, unbleached version. Some of the more refined sugars are listed here, including some of the brown sugars and raw sugar. It's still stripped white sugar with molasses added back, and while there's a little bit of nutrients in that, it's better to get something more natural. A raw honey, a grade B maple syrup, a sucanat, which is a sugar cane natural, or evaporated cane juice or something like that. And you might be surprised at the amount of sugar in things. So particularly fruit juice and dried fruits, they have quite a bit of sugars in them, and it's easy for those to add up. And also, interestingly, one tablespoon of ketchup has one teaspoon of sugar. And so you can see that's quite a bit of sugar. It's something people don't really even think about. So the other thing to remove is reactive foods and inflammatory proteins, so some of those things that the diets are based on. And when we get to the diets, we'll talk about these and more. So what to replenish? We want a healthy diet. So, well, you can't see this very well because it's not layered with my animation. Whole foods, unprocessed, organic. We want to get good quality foods as healthy as possible. We want to get fermented foods, grass-fed meats, good fats, and foods that are low in food intolerances, so avoiding those in the diet. So some of the nutrient-dense foods to be aware of, is going to be this list that we're going to talk about now. So, you can see some of the nutrients that are deficient and some of the foods that are rich in them. So, kids aren't necessarily going to go out right away and eat liver, but you might be surprised that there are some really good recipes that I have for you know, burgers with liver and things like that, that, believe it or not, it's one of kids' favorite recipes. So don't, let's not assume that, well, I'm not going to go out and expect they're going to eat liver and onions and they're going to go out and have, ginger-flavored green beans with, broccoli and, nettles or something. But we might be able to add those foods to things that taste good and get some of those nutrients that way. So we'll talk a little bit about some of those foods today, but we might not get into all of them. So I'll give you some resources at the end to help you come up with some ways to get some of these good nutrients in. Juicing is one of those good ways. So stored and pasteurized juices contain significantly less nutrients than the fresh juices. You lose sometimes 3/4 or more of some of these nutrients in all of that process. So getting them fresh is firstly going to take a lot of vegetables and some fruits in a very concentrated form, so you can get a lot in a small space and in a form that kids like. So if they don't like vegetables because they're mushy or slimy or slippery, then you can get these nutrients in a juice, which is a form that kids often do like. Fermented foods. So I want to talk about that good bacteria. When you hear about fermented foods, they contain probiotics, which are those good bacteria that are in the gut. And look at all the things that these good bacteria do for us. They help with breaking down toxins. They help with keeping the bowels moving properly, not too fast, not too slow. They produce B vitamins and all sorts of other important nutrients. They help to break down our foods. They help to reduce inflammation and support the immune system. So these good bacteria are really important, and you can get them from supplement form. But I highly recommend looking at ways of getting good fermented foods in the diet. Let's talk about what some of those foods are. And again, I'll just say that there are some really creative ways that parents have come up with and that I talk about in terms of how to make these kids friendly. So again, if you have a child that's eating, 10 foods, probably fermented foods are not on their list and might not be on your top list of first things to think about. But be aware that there's some really simple ways like pureeing sauerkraut into an applesauce or something. So keep that in mind. Raw sauerkraut is a form of cultured vegetable, and there's lots of different cultured vegetables. These are ways of getting that good bacteria in. Non-dairy yogurts, whether that's coconut or nut milk yogurts, whether you make them yourself or buy them. Beverages, kombucha, young coconut kefir, which is in the Body Ecology diet, and various foods like that. Okay, so meat is often something that we want to focus on, making sure we get some good quality animal foods in. But it's often something that kids do eat to some extent, so it is something that we can use as a way of getting good nutrients. And when you think of nutritional value, firstly, let me step back and talk a little bit about what grass-fed is. So grass-fed means that these animals are in their most natural environment. They're outside. They're eating green grass, they're getting sunlight, and they're getting a lot of the nutrients and things they would naturally get. When they are outside eating grass, they get vitamin A, they get vitamin E and vitamin K. When they're getting the sunlight, they're getting vitamin D, and they're converting that sunlight into vitamin D. So they're the animal foods, the eggs, dairy, if you consumed it, would be much richer in these important nutrients. And in the case of eggs, the eggs is really where you're going to find much more of the omega-3s. Now, eggs are not necessarily grass-fed because chickens don't really eat much grass, but they do eat a little bit of grass and clover and things, and they peck around outside. They get access to bugs and things like that, and that is going to significantly increase their nutritional value, giving them 10 times the amount of omega-3s, four times the amount of vitamin E, and so on. So it is really important to get good quality foods. it is a little hard to come by these, so you really want to seek them out because it's highly worth your while. So looking at ways of not just organic, because organic is not necessarily grass-fed and actually often isn't, but going with grass-fed, which is sort of a step above organic. And you can find these often at good health food stores, but things like pastured eggs, you might actually have to go to a farmer's market or somewhere like a buying co-op or something to get pastured eggs, because free-range eggs and cage-free are not pastured. Pastured is often a much significant higher level of quality. So looking at other ways, bone broths and vegetable broths provide nutrients in a very easy-to-absorb form. So it is something that we can use. And the store-bought ones often contain a lot of problematic ingredients. So we have a lot of reasons that these bone broths can add good calcium and minerals, trace minerals, and things like that. So when you do so, you want to make it yourself. And, you know, you can use this in the form of course, soup, but lots of kids don't like soup, so you can even cook your grains and other things in here. All right. So what are some supplements? So I'm just going to talk about a few of the basics, just to get people an idea of. You want to get supplementation because there are certain things that, especially with picky eaters right now, they might not be getting their needs met for calcium if they're on a casein-free diet. Calcium is really important. So you can see a typical 800 to 1,200 milligrams a day of calcium is fairly standard from your food and your supplementation. So that's an important one to think about. Also, if you can do a multivitamin, that's great, but if you have a child that's fairly sensitive, you might start with one nutrient at a time. So zinc is an important one. Magnesium and B6, this is a combination that Dr. Bernard Rimland studied quite a bit and found some really good benefits for. And then folic acid, or I would like to say folate, or some of the more significant forms like folinic acid or 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, but though that category of vitamin. Digestive enzymes can be very helpful. They are not a replacement for doing diet, but they can help to mop up some of the accidental infractions or cross-contamination or things like that. So I think that they're often very helpful for helping people, especially because digestion often can use a little bit of a boost. Probiotic supplements are a good way to get a wide range of different good bacteria, and some fish oils, often in the form of cod liver oil. Cod liver oil is going to be higher in DHA and higher in vitamin A, helping with the immune system and things. So usually people will try cod liver oil. But there are other reasons and benefits for fish oil, too. So, you know, it is going to be dependent on the individual. So I highly recommend that you work with a biomedical physician that can help you do some testing, find out which nutrients are low, and help to support you in getting the right nutrients for your child. All right, let's talk about some of those autism diets. Particularly, I want to talk about the GFCF diet. So this is a chart of some of the most common ones. You might have had seen some, parents that you know try some of these various diets. And, of course, the diet that they use that works for their child is, of course, the diet you should try, which, of course, makes sense. However, it gets confusing then because someone says, oh, you have to try SCD. Oh, you have to try low oxalate. Oh, you have to try just GFCF. So I want to talk a little bit about each briefly so that you can have a little bit of an idea of maybe where you want to start and give you a sense of why some people choose what they choose and why it's helpful. So the list on the right-hand side explains what some of these various diets are and how many children they would be children because they're children of the parents that are responding to them. What they have found to be the highest level of improvement. So, but I'd say look at that as an overall understanding that all of these diets offer benefit, because it depends on the individual of which diet you might choose. So we're going to go into detail about the GFCF diet. I won't talk more about that now, and a little bit about food sensitivities. But I want to talk a bit about specific carbohydrate diet. This diet and the GAPS diet, which is based on the specific carbohydrate diet, are really good choices. They often help with significant gut inflammation, inflammatory bowel conditions, and things like that. This is an area when you have a lot of dysbiosis and pathogenic organisms in the gut. This diet can help starve those out and get foods that are easy to digest and don't require a lot of carbohydrate digesting enzymes. So this is a fairly restrictive diet in terms of it's going to not only remove gluten, but all grains and all starchy vegetables and things like that. But it is a wonderful diet for people that need it. It can be very helpful. The Feingold and the Failsafe diet, this removes those high phenolic foods that we had talked about a bit earlier. These are the foods that often create hyperactivity, red cheeks, red ears, and a variety of other challenges, sleeping challenges and various things, cravings for these particular foods. These foods are things like apples, grapes, berries, ketchup or tomatoes, those kinds of foods. So be aware, there was quite a bit of work done by Dr. Rosemary Waring, and she found quite a large number of children with autism have imbalances in the pathways that process these. So they're something to really think about. The body ecology diet's a good diet when you're looking at yeast overgrowth and helping with the gut. The Weston A. Price principles are not so much a diet as I think of, but as a kind of a good nourishing principles that you might want to add and layer on to any diet. And I'm actually talking about quite a few of those today. And the low oxalate diet. This is a newer diet, but I have seen some really wonderful results with this diet. It's a diet that I'm using quite a bit more to help address looking at things like not only things like sandy stools and cloudy urine and that kind of thing, but working with motor skills and mitochondrial cellular function, things like that. And we're seeing some really interesting and positive benefit from that. So I won't probably be going into much more detail on a lot of those other diets, but I just want you to know that they are there. One of the things I do most in my practice is often help parents layer various diets. So they might be doing GFCF and they want to know, well, should I add, some low oxalate, should I remove some phenols? And we help to determine what to remove. Because what can happen sometimes is, You look at these and it's easy to think, oh, well, then these are bad. I need to remove them. But then the diet gets so restrictive. And so the goal for me is to help people is to remove the things that are really causing a problem, but not overly restricting the diet. We want to keep as much variety in, as much rotation and stuff as possible, but by also removing those things that we know are a problem. So being selective in what we remove. The gluten-free and casein-free diet. This is a diet that removes foods, particularly, let me start with talking a little bit about food allergies versus food sensitivities. So food allergies are it's considered an IgE reaction. Those are, you eat peanuts and you go into anaphylactic shock, or you eat strawberries and break out in hives. That's a very immediate, acute reaction, and that's a food allergy. What we're talking about mostly with the GFCF diet is food sensitivities. Now, there are kids with autism that have allergies to various foods, but usually when we're talking about why someone's responding to gluten or dairy, it's usually because of a sensitivity. So if you went to your doctor and were tested for, quote, food allergies, and they did a skin test, and your child comes up not allergic to wheat and dairy, that still doesn't mean that they wouldn't benefit. In fact, a large, vast majority of the time, kids are not allergic to these foods, but they're sensitive to them. And while there are tests that you can do to try to find out some of that, they're not 100% accurate, and really the best way to do it is just to try the diet and see how it goes, because there's so many ways somebody could be reacting. It's better to just try the diet and see how the child or individual does with that elimination. And in addition to gluten and casein, it might be soy or corn or eggs or various foods like that as well. Okay, these are some of the more common ones. All right, so gluten and casein. So we want to remove it because you can have an IgG response, like I mentioned. You can have an opiate response we talked about earlier, a various inflammatory or autoimmune responses. Celiac is an autoimmune response to gluten. Let's see, what else can I say? So really, since you could, like I said earlier, the best thing to do is just try the diet and see how it works. So a little background on that. So normally you have this long protein chain. In this case, the protein chain might be a gluten chain or a dairy chain. And we want to break those down into their little individual amino acids. In a healthy gut, you have the enzymes that you need. You break down these proteins into little individual amino acids that are able to absorb through the gut and then be assembled into various proteins and things that the body needs. With a healthy gut also, those larger protein chains don't absorb. So you only get the absorption of the things that the body should be absorbing. We have enzymes that help with that. And with children and adults with autism, we often have a diminished a number of these enzymes in the gut and a decrease in the enzyme DPP4 that helps to break down the gluten and casein opiates and protein response. So when you look further, you see that that's often damaged by pesticides and heavy metals. So, you know, you can see how this cycle really perpetuates itself. So when the gut is not healthy, and what can happen is that you don't break down those long chains of gluten and casein all the way. They get broken down into these chains, and then they can leak into the bloodstream and form an opiate or an opioid-type compound. So an opioid-like substance, like a morphine-like substance. So normally a healthy gut wouldn't absorb these big protein chains, but in an inflamed gut, unfortunately, they don't get all the way broken down, and these large chains can leak into the bloodstream and can function and fit into that opiate receptor like opiates. So what are some of the signs of opiates? So if you think about that, when you think of, say, morphine, you think of high pain tolerance, so not feeling much pain. Very spacey, could be hallucinations and mood changes and poor eye contact and various things. So you think about that, then you can think, wow, you know, this is a lot of what we also see with autism. And parents, when they remove the gluten and the dairy from their diet, they subsequently also see a reduction in a lot of these symptoms. So we can see on many levels, in addition to testing the opiates in the urine, we can often see how these symptoms go hand in hand, and the removal and reduction goes along with the GFCF diet. So why the GFCF diet works? Well, we're going to eliminate those opiate peptides. We're going to reduce the inflammatory compounds they get and reduce those IgG antibodies and the reactions, the foods that are causing more inflammation and gut, leaky gut. And by removing those wheat and dairy-based foods, they're often foods that often contain preservatives and a substance called propionate, calcium propionate, which in the work of Dr. McFabe was found to create autism symptoms, autistic-like symptoms in the rats that he studied. a little bit of the scientific rationale. A lot of people say that there is no science behind diet, and that's absolutely not true. In fact, even in the last year, there are some more studies that I haven't even had a chance to put on this list yet, although those are reflected in various writings and things that I have and that you can find online, so you can get access to those as well. So I don't want to spend too much time on this slide. Just want to simply say that there was a boy that had celiac. He actually was diagnosed with autism first, and then he was diagnosed with celiac, and so they removed gluten from his diet. When they removed gluten from his diet, all of his autistic symptoms went away, and he actually was undiagnosed with autism. So most people with autism don't have celiac. But you can see here the power of a gluten intolerance for some people. It can create a lot of symptoms, and that really helps to support what we see in clinical practice and what we see with parents' experience, that removing these foods, gluten and dairy, can have a significant impact on many of their symptoms of autism. So these are some of those gluten-containing grains and foods. You know, in addition to wheat, you've also got rye, barley, spelt, kamut, triticale. And you can get gluten-free oats, but all the oats that are out there are going to have cross-contamination with gluten. So you'd only want to use a certified gluten-free oat and make something with it if you were going to use oats. Here are some of the gluten-free grains. So there are a lot of choices that you have: rice, millet, quinoa, amaranth, buckwheat, corn, if you do corn. You know, you can do some of the flours that you wouldn't necessarily, you know, you wouldn't cook, you know, we wouldn't necessarily cook some of these as grains, but you would have them specifically in flour form, like sorghum flour, tapioca flour, potato starch, those kinds of things. And there's a variety of thickeners as well. Casein-containing foods, so being careful of milk from all animals. So there are some distinctions. I'm not going to go into those now. If someone has a question for me about that, I'm happy to go into it. But for now, just be aware that to do a true gluten and casein trial, you want to remove all animal milk and all animal milk products. And here are some of the substitutes that people will often use. I personally am not a fan of soy, so you'll see here that I avoid soy in all of my suggested choices as well. Leading on into that, the perfect segue, just wanted to say it's very difficult to digest soy, very inflammatory to the gut. It's broken down by the same enzyme that breaks down gluten and casein, so it is not a good substitute to use for those reasons as well, because if you're avoiding gluten and casein, you want to avoid soy too. Soy inhibits and blocks the absorption of calcium and magnesium and various other minerals because of the phytic acid, or what they call phytates, and oxalates and lectins. And it can inhibit thyroid function and disrupt endocrine function. And so soy is just not a good choice for a vast majority of people. So what is diet strategy? Normally the slide, again, would have some animation to make it a little less overwhelming. You know, you want to start, typically, most people will start with a GFCF diet. Sometimes people will start with a specific carbohydrate diet. And then you can adjust and layer various diets or components of diets to come up with the diet that's best for your child. Now, these diets, many of them, especially things like the gluten-free and casein-free diet, you want to do that diet 100%, no infractions. Every infraction requires days to weeks to months for the body to get back and get all of those inflammatory compounds and things out of the system. So really, you want to be very, very committed to the diet when you start and be able to do your best to do it 100%. Whereas some of the other diets, they can be a reduction in some of the things. So what I want to say there, I guess, is that sometimes you might add or combine or layer various diets together. And then what you end up is a diet that's best for your child. And really, since every child is different, every time I work with a family, I'm always customizing a diet to meet the individual needs of that child. Okay, let's talk about picky eaters before we jump into some questions here. So I want to talk a little bit about some of those common causes of picky eating. I think that this is will be really helpful to you, to those of you who are have picky eaters. So one thing to be aware of, one of the most common things I hear about the reason for parents not starting the gluten-free and casein-free diet is that their child only eats wheat and dairy-containing foods, and there would be nothing for them to eat. If they only eat five foods, and they're all chicken nuggets, macaroni and cheese, bread, milk, and pasta, then the parents don't know how they're going to take those foods out or get that or to do that diet. On one hand, that's completely understandable, but on the other hand, that's even more reason likely that these children really need this diet, because most likely they're eating and self-selecting those foods, possibly because of the addictive properties of those opiates. So a larger number of children and people with autism have those opiates created in, they create them in the body, and so they're much more likely to be addicted to those foods. So when you're addicted to those foods, you love those foods, you are not going to be interested in anything else. So that transition, we can talk a little bit about that transition. You may seek out some help if your child is super, super limited, but be aware that I just want to say that alone is not necessarily a reason not to do the diet. It's a reason to seek out some help in doing the diet. You can also be addicted to various chemicals, the MSG, the artificial additives. So if your child only likes one brand of something, look at the ingredients and see if there might be something in there that they're addicted to. Nutrient deficiencies can create, especially zinc, can create poor sense of smell and sense of taste. So it makes everything taste bland or not good. So being aware that as you work on boosting up nutrient status, sometimes the picky eating changes over time anyway. When you look at yeast overgrowth and other microorganisms that feed on sugar and refined carbohydrates, your child might be on a GFCF diet, but they might only eat gluten-free chicken nugget. No, I'm sorry, let me take that back. They might only eat, French fries and chips and pretzels. The gluten-free version, so if we look at simply, the things like gluten-free pretzels and gluten-free French fries, we're still going to be eating an enormous amount of carbohydrate that can be feeding that yeast, because that yeast sends a signal to the brain to get us to crave more carbohydrates. So something else to think about is the picky eating. You've already gone GFCF, but you're not seeing the benefit you want. They're eating tons of carbs and limited foods still. Consider whether that might be something to address. And I have seen children that once they've addressed yeast have expanded their diet fairly considerably. So there's lots of things that you can look at there. So just some sort of understanding of what might be underlying some of this. But there are also other things that aren't necessarily diet related, so sensory issues, texture issues, anxieties around things. And this would be a reason that you might seek out help from a feeding therapist. So I'm not a feeding therapist, so the suggestions I have here are more just from experience of what parents tell me is helpful and just ways to get started. So, things like only adding one new food, a very small amount, letting them experience it without having to swallow it and eat a lot of it, all of that. But I think another one is just really starting to understand your child in terms of what don't they like about something. You know, I try to spend a lot of time to figure out what foods a child likes and what they have in common. So are they all crunchy? Are they not wet and slippery? Do they have a certain flavor? Do they look a certain way? So those things can be really helpful as well. And then be aware to seek a feeding therapist when you need to. A lot of people don't even know that a feeding therapist is really available. You might start with your OT or your speech therapist to see if they have any recommendations. Some of these people do this for a living. Some people do little parts of it or can do some basic evaluation. Others, you might refer you to a certified feeding therapist. That is really helpful because some children that are really, really extreme picky eaters, what they call problem feeders, they might just stop eating altogether, or they might start to limit their food even more if you start to, what I would say, mess with it too much. So, know your child and determine whether you think that you want to take this and run with it and get creative, or if you think you could use some support once you've come up with some of these creative ideas that we're going to talk about next. All right. So there's a few areas to think about. The first one I like to look at is texture. It tends to be a big challenge. So looking at texture, visual appearance, and then making things fun. So sometimes simply dipping sauces, for kids that like dipping sauces, can make a food that they don't normally like something fun and enjoyable. So keep all of those things in mind. We're going to start with some things about texture. So a couple things. A few of my favorites for texture are things like what I call in my cookbook, and we're going to show them in a second here, is the veggie latkes. And they're basically shredded vegetables that are made nice and crispy so that we can change that texture to a texture that kids like. Also, kids don't often like beans and that texture of beans that's mushy. But if we make them into a bean burger, it's nice and firm and has good texture, can give us some good antioxidants and fiber that they might be needing. Juicing, we talked about how that can be good for texture. And for really, really restrictive kids that don't like vegetables at all, starting with something simple like a vegetable chip or a carrot chip can be a good way to start. So the veggie latkes, as I mentioned, this tends to be just from my cookbook and my cooking course, Cooking to Heal. But the gist of it is this is a specific carbohydrate diet version of this food. But you can also make it, you can also shred potato if you want to make it a little bit more starchy, a little bit more of a hash brown-like texture, and just shred some potato and some other vegetables, and again, make it into a patty and fry it so it's crispy. And that can help a lot. Add a little salt, too. Give it a little flavor if anything's too bland. Give it a little punch of flavor. It's good. Some of the beans, like I said, the bean burgers I take, again, this is another recipe that can be made specific carbohydrate diet compliant. You can make it on the lower oxalate side, depending on which seeds and things you choose. So you take some cooked beans, some ground up seeds, some vegetables, pulse them a little bit in the food processor, break them up a little bit, and then mix them all together and form yourself into some patties and cook those. They're really good for texture. For kids with a lot of texture issues, you can make them really thin. You can dust them in some sort of a crunchy gluten-free cereal or some flour, and you can even bread them and fry them a little bit. You can get really creative with some of these things. The juicing we talked about. And the carrot chips. So carrot chips are another one of my favorites. You can do carrots, you can do beets, you can do butternut squash. There's a variety of different vegetables you can use. And, you know, this is, to me, a starting point, an entry into the world of vegetables if your child won't eat a single vegetable. Can kind of just get them interested and excited about eating vegetables. So keep this in mind as you're navigating where you want to go. Visual presentation. So these are these are, you know, a little bit on the more elaborate side, but I love the little hot dogs made into the octopus or the egg mold there on the top left. That little bunny is actually a hard-boiled egg. You can do little mini quail eggs, and you can do little forms like that. They have little forms that you can buy at Japanese stores. You can make just even a little mound of rice with a little happy face on it. Whatever works for you or for your child, I think can be fun. Also, pancakes. So if your child likes pancakes, you can make pancakes into various forms. If they don't like them, you could try this as well. So chicken pancakes is one of my favorites. If you make it fun into one of their favorite characters or something, they might not notice so much that it, you know, that it tastes more like chicken, but it has a great texture too. So chicken pancakes is actually another one of my favorites. But yeah, make them visually interesting. You can do a variety of things to actually get some more nutrition by putting some spreads, doing some designs with various spreads that can have some purees and things in them as well. Dipping sauces. Here's some of the dipping sauces. Many of these are also in my book, but you can find so many different dipping sauces in a variety of different places. All right, so I'm just going to get a few getting started tips, and we're going to get started with those questions in just a moment. So where do we go? Let's say to get started, remove those artificial ingredients as the number one thing. And then you can look at implementing a diet, and in the case you can, I start with experimenting. So start with anything they currently like, substitute it. So if they like pasta, go with a rice pasta. They like waffle, do a gluten-free waffle. Experiment, see what choices you have and you can come up with. Then you can explore some diet books and some various resources and recipes and see what else you can find. And then start to create a meal plan, breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, and find out, put them into some categories and say, okay, I've got a bunch of breakfasts and some snacks, and where do I want to go from here? Then what you can do is that you can start with the shopping for those foods, getting yourself all ready. Then you can look at implementation. And with implementation, you might start with one food first, like maybe dairy, remove that first, then go to gluten. It can be done in a variety of ways, but just starting with some sort of introductory, sort of slow introduction of the diet, just to do things slowly over some time, and then follow it for a period of time. And chart your progress. Always only add one new thing, one new food, or one diet change, or one new supplement at a time. And always be aware to write things down so you can start to make some correlations, because you might notice that some things got better and some things got worse, and you can take that diet record and look through it and try to figure out what patterns you can see. And also, I think equally helpful is to take that to a qualified nutritionist or somebody that has experience with diet that might be able to find patterns in there that you weren't able to see. When you make some diet changes, you want to look for improvements. So improvements in digestive, hyperactivity and attention, maybe irritability, things like that, language, the things we talked about earlier. And then regression, you want to see, is this regression a short-term positive thing associated with the removal of opiates, which you can imagine, you know, if you're addicted to these, they'll act like drugs and you can get a withdrawal reaction. Or is it possible that a new food was substituted in its place and maybe that food was equally problematic? And that happens a lot too. So I just want to say, don't get discouraged. If you don't give up on diet, if you're not seeing the results you want, work with someone that can help you and support you with some of that, because many times I've seen parents that, unknowingly, they just added something else in the diet that their child also had a problem with, and that started to mask any beneficial results that they might have seen because of this new thing they added. All right, so I just want to share some ways that I can be of support. I have a Facebook group. We have nearly 3,000 parents on there. Myself and all of the parents offer some great ideas and thoughts and support, so join us on that. my cookbook and my basically my cooking DVDs, my all-day cooking class I put on video, along with the workbook that's used in the class and all of the recipes from class are in there. So that can be a nice way, since a lot of people can't make it to San Francisco, to go to a class. You can get all of that online. And we have a variety of things on that. I list everything. Firstly, everything is GFCF, soy-free, corn-free. And I have, whenever possible, tagged every recipe when they're nut-free or egg-free, as well as specific carbohydrate diet, fine, gold, fail-safe, body ecology, low oxalate, whatever diet you might have to follow, whatever combination of diets. You can very quickly look at each recipe and find out which ones meet the needs of your child. And then my book. So my book, Nourishing Hope, really goes into a lot of the underlying biochemistry, if that's interesting to you, to help you piece some of these together, help to provide some supportive scientific background for members of your family that really need to understand the why this diet works, support that you could show your physician if they're open-minded and want to understand a little bit more about this. The impact of nutrients, I list all the different various nutrients, the different diets. In fact, they go through like 13 different diets and which ones to use when, as well as that 12-step guide that you saw. So this is a lot of the background nutrition information, and Cooking to Heal is a lot of the how-to and put it together with the recipes. So hopefully you'll find those tools really useful for you. You can find those on my website. And if I can do anything for you personally, I do a lot of nutrition support and consultations by telephone and Skype from people around the world. And so if I can help you, you can call our offices and set up some time for a free 15-minute consultation to see if I might be of help or to set up an appointment. So here's my information to do that. And with that, I want to take the last 15 minutes and have Nancy open up the line and figure out some questions that we can answer.
Wonderful, wonderful. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, I muted myself earlier. I wasn't sure if I unmuted. I had a question. Is anyone in your household on a diet?
Well, I have a child, but she's only a baby, mm-hmm. so we haven't necessarily had a diagnosis where we've needed to implement these specifically. But yeah, we are pretty much a gluten-free household, and we do some. We're a completely soy-free household, and I've done the GFCF diet myself. I've done the specific carbohydrate diet before myself as well, because I've actually done a vegan diet, a vegetarian. I've tried, as a nutritionist, I love to experiment and try different things. So I have a lot of personal experience, and for the most part, my house is gluten-free and soy-free for sure. So,
there's always talk about how to start the diet, when to start the diet, but no one ever talks about how to end the diet or when to end the diet. Hmm. Is there ever a sign that says maybe it's okay to go ahead and reintroduce some of these things?
That's a really good question. I would say yes and no. So yes, there's often a time where people can change the diet. So it depends what diet it is. So some diets are really made to be more of a interim short, I don't want to say short term, but not a lifelong thing. So often the specific carbohydrate diet often has a healing period of time, and once the gut gets to a certain place, often people might go off of that diet. And the same might go true for any diet. So how does someone know? There isn't 100% answer to that. So there is no exact test that you can do that's going to tell you that. But what I like to think about is when an individual is doing well, when they are doing, it depends. Well for one individual is different for another, but usually their digestion is a lot better. They're not having the digestive disturbances, the diarrhea, constipation, gas, bloating. They feel like they've got, conquered yeast to some extent. And also you're getting the changes you want in terms of symptoms and behavior and all of that. So usually I would wait until someone's at a really solid, good space. if there's up and down still going on, I wouldn't consider that a time to go off the diet. But if everything's going in a really going super, then I think that there is the possibility of either going off the diet or changing the diet to another diet. You know, gluten and casein tend to be a little bit more sometimes you have a larger percentage of people that need to kind of follow this for more lifelong, because a lot of people are gluten intolerant. So I'd say yes, when things seem to be going well, when you add something back, you're often able to see whether there's a negative sign to that or negative symptom associated. But be a little careful, because you might add something back once and it might be okay. But if you start adding it every day, you might see a problem. So just keeping aware of, as you're doing that, what you notice and, you know, if you want to pull back on it again.
Okay. I want to let our telephone callers know that if you'd like to ask a question, please press *2, and that will alert me that you have a question. In the meantime, I'll go to our questions that have come in through the website. Let's see. Nicole from Mississippi asks, is there any danger of getting sick from using raw honey?
Let me say. Well, so firstly, the big issue, obviously, with honey is often botulism, right? It's botulism spores that can turn into the organism. But that's really in an immature gut of a baby. So that's why babies can't have honey, just in case that happens. I have not heard any cases of other people really getting sick from it. In fact, it's used widely on the specific carbohydrate diet, and I have not heard of any instances. So I guess with anything, there's always, I guess, in just eating food in general, there's always the possibility of some contamination or problem with it. But I wouldn't say, a widespread problem where I would, feel like there would be a need to be a warning for, a majority of the children.
And can you put the slide back up that has the good foods, the safe foods, 16? I think it was 16.
Oh, yeah.
The clean 16.
Yep. Let me find it. Here we go.
Okay. We had a couple of people ask to see that again, so
we'll
put that up for a little bit.
Yep.
And this question is asked over and over again. Is there a good bread substitute?
Yes. So I think the two hardest things on a gluten-free and casein-free diet, for gluten, it's bread, and for dairy, it's cheese. So there are a couple options. The more restrictive you get, the harder it is to find a good bread. So if it's gluten-free, that's one thing. If it's gluten-free and yeast-free, that's even harder sometimes, or egg-free, that's even harder. So I'd say just for your basic gluten-free bread, there's a couple good, I think, store-bought varieties. And let me see. I don't think I put them on that slide, so I'll just say what they are. Udi's, U-D-I, Udi's is, I think, a great one. They make bread, bagels, and pizza crust. And Rudy's with an R, a little confusing, but they're pretty good as well, although I kind of like Udi's a little better. And the other thing to think about is making your own bread, because the texture is so much better. So if I had to do a yeast-free bread or find a way to make an egg-free bread, because these other breads aren't egg-free, I would most likely go with a homemade bread. And there are some really good bread mixes you can do. I personally like breads from Anna, and I think her breads are really easy to make and great in terms of yeast-free. They're gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free, corn-free, rice-free. They can be made egg-free, too, and they're yeast-free. So, yeah, they're really, I think, very tasty and good texture. And then, by the way, just the cheese question. It's often the two cheeses that are gluten-free, they're gluten-free, casein-free, and soy-free are Diet Cheese and Galaxy Foods makes one particular food called their rice vegan cheese. But Daiya is spelled D-A-I-Y-A.
Okay. Had a couple of people ask how to do gluten-free, casein-free, organic, on a budget.
Ah, okay, great. A couple things. Anytime you cook things yourself, it's going to be much more cost-effective. So, for example, if you made your own chicken nuggets rather than buying the packaged ones, that's a great way to go. If you make your own pancakes rather than buying the frozen ones, that's also a good way to go. So that's one piece to think of. Buying those individual, flours can be, a good cost saver. And a lot of things, and a lot of inherent gluten-free things like eggs and, all of that stuff. Not buying the processed cereals, which are really expensive. Hopefully maybe you'd avoid those and get something a little more nutritious, like maybe a hot cereal or something. But answering the organics part of it, there's a couple really good things, I think, is that one is farmers markets. And so I have a couple markets in the city, in San Francisco, where I'm from. One of the five most famous farmers markets in the country is in my town. And it is wonderful. It's got everything I could ever need. However, it's expensive. I can go down the street to another one where it's much more local farmers, and I can often get a lot of really good seasonal things. If I wanted to buy 10 pounds of apples to make a bunch of applesauce, I can get it really much cheaper than I can at the fancy farmers market. So, look around for some farmers markets like that. The other thing I like to do is, for meat, I like to go in on some buying clubs. So, you might look for Weston A. Price, a Weston A. Price chapter near you, which you can find at Weston. I was on one of my slides. It's Weston, W-E-S-T-O-N. A as in apple, price as in price tag, .org, WestonAPrice.org. And they have chapters all over the world. If you find a chapter near you, you can talk to those people and often go in on a buying club where you buy a half a cow. But you're not going to get a slab of a half a cow. You're going to get everything all broken up into little parts. And I can get the meat and things half the price of what I can get at the market for those same grass-fed things. And the same goes for if you can get some eggs. I can get my eggs for $6 rather than $8 a dozen. It's still a little pricey, but, when you think that there's 10 times the amount of good fats and I can get them for twice the price, I'm getting a good deal.
Mm-hmm. And are there any good egg substitutes?
There are some egg substitutes, and it depends what someone needs them for. So I talk about a whole variety of them, but I think there's two kind of main things. One is whether you need it as a leavening agent, like you would use for pancakes or muffins, or whether you want a binding agent, like you would use for meatballs or something like that. So for a leavening agent or a baking agent, I like flax seeds and chia seeds. Mm-hmm. And you'd put, 1 tablespoon of flaxseed with 3 tablespoons of water, blend it in a food processor or a blender. It will make an egg white type of consistency, and it often makes a nice texture to those kinds of needs. And also a binder, usually purees, like a sweet potato puree or squash puree, often help as a binder. Those are a couple. There's a lot of other choices for people that can't do their SCD and they can't, there's lots of other choices, but those are probably a couple of the biggest.
Okay. Nicole from Mississippi asks, if you are avoiding soy, is there harm in using foods with soy lecithin?
So I try to avoid that as well, but if you notice a big problem with soy, you might need to avoid all soy, including the soy lecithin. But if you don't notice that, you probably can get away with some small amounts of that in one or two of their foods if you really don't have another good choice. So I don't think it's going to mess up the whole thing and create a bunch of inflammation unless you notice the child's super sensitive.
Okay. I think we have time for one more question, and then if people want to ask you a question, they can go to info@nourishinghope.com.
Yeah, let me give you a couple things. I would say a couple things. You can definitely go to info@nourishinghope.com and also ask the question on my Facebook group, too, is a good way because I'll go there as well. But definitely you can contact me at info@nourishinghope.com.
Okay. Mary from Florida asks, on your second to last slide, you said cleaning up the home under holistic approach. Mm-hmm. She's questioning what you mean by that.
I'm thinking of cleaners, you know, chemical cleaners, household things, things that have a strong chemical smell to them or strong fragrance to them, like fabric softener and things like that.
Okay. I want to thank you for joining us, Julie. This has been just wonderful. I have notes and notes and notes. And as a mom... I know when we did the GFCF diet with our son, I was overwhelmed, and I know a lot of listeners are, but what I did, I just started substituting what he already ate with the GFCF version, and that seemed to be the easiest approach for us. He had a very limited diet, so finding, you know, making my own chicken nuggets, for instance, substituting the gluten-free pretzels for his regular cheese crackers. Just finding substitutes. He loves the chocolate almond milk. He just loves it. And then the rice milk as well, for putting over a cereal or something like that, or just drinking a glass of. He just loves. So.
Okay. Well, thank you. I mean, it's always great to hear. I think the most powerful thing is hearing from other parents and how successful the diet's been and the choices that they made. So I'm glad to hear that, and I'm so glad to have been able to be here today.
Thank you so much. I want to let our listeners know as well that if you want a transcript of this event, you can join our Spectrum Gold Club by clicking the button on the screen. You will receive a copy of this webinar audio and transcript, as well as 29 other webinars when you join. And please let us know what you see.